ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why do humans hold on to stuff? Oddments we don't use, and yet can't quite throw out. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? I'm Annabelle Crabb. Come and have a rummage through the story of us told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. How far into the game will blood be shed in the footy match? Which country will come last in Eurovision? What colour Gatorade will the Super Bowl winner's coach get doused in? We Aussies can turn pretty much anything into a bet, but our love of a punt costs us billions of dollars a year. Sean McAuliffe's been looking into our relationship with gambling. You'll hear what he's found out in the next 15 minutes. Also ahead, if matching your kids' socks sounds like a drag and bedtime is more of a vibe than an actual time, you may be employing the beta parenting method. Does giving it a name turn it into a badge of honour or an excuse? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, you've heard it before, the victors shape history, the winners, the people who come out on top. So what does it mean when so many of these so-called winners are blokes? Less than 4% of statues in Australia are of real Australian women, which should tell you a bit about how and who gets immortalised in bronze. It's shaped by the historian's personal values, their ideals and beliefs, as much as it is by what actually happened. So what would happen if someone from outside this tent got access to one of the country's biggest historical archives, like, say, the National Library of Australia, and got to shape a bit of history themselves? Because here with me is Sita Sargent. She is the CEO of She Shapes History, a project that grew out of frustration with a lack of representation of the women who, well, like it says on the tin, shape history. Sita, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you for having me.
So you started out in Canberra as a walking tour, but this passion has really built into something of an empire.
Yeah, I feel like it's taken over my life and a few other people's. It started with as a side hustle that made me absolutely no money in 2021 and then just grew and grew. And we now have a team of 32 guides across four cities in Australia and five full-time staff, which just gives me heart palpitations whenever I say that number.
That's wild. We'll hear a bit more about what you're doing these days with it. But tell me, like, take me back to that beginning point. What was it that got you fired up enough to start this?
Like you said, a lot of frustration. I had moved back to Canberra, which was the city that I grew up in, and I was kind of trapped there during the pandemic. So like many people, I started deep diving on a topic, and my topic was Australian history. And what got me is I kept coming across these incredible stories of women who had made this country what it is, but they were never being positioned as central characters in the story of Australia. And I think the thing that really just pushed me over the edge was finding out that Canberra, you know, Australia's capital city, was designed in large part by a woman, Marion Marnie Griffin.
Really?
Yeah. So she was the one who did all of the illustrations. She was the one who did the research into the natural landscape. She was the one who she was one of the first women in America to graduate with an architecture degree. She was this absolute powerhouse. And despite putting in all of this work to this design and literally illustrating it, her and Walter Burley Griffin, her husband, decided to leave her name off the competition entry because they assumed if her name was on it, then it just wouldn't get taken seriously. So it means from the very first days of Canberra as a capital, you have the contributions of a woman being erased. And I just thought, gosh, you know, if I'm finding this out in my like 20s, that a woman is behind this city that I grew up in, like what else am I missing?
So who else did you find when you started digging? Do you have some favourite stories that you uncovered?
Oh, I adore the story of the very first woman who ever voted in Australia. And I think this is probably the story that got me really excited about Australian history. So she's the most unlikely person to hold this title. Her name is Fanny Finch. She was a woman of colour of African British heritage. She was a single mother of four, and she was living in Castlemaine, so regional Victoria. And she ends up voting in 1856, which is, for those of you who aren't as deep in Australian history as me, that's about 50 years before women gain the right to vote in this country. And she ends up voting because of this, just because she was a small business owner who had become so fed up and frustrated at this really corrupt business owner down the street who decided to run for parliament, the local council. And she just went, you know, this man would make a terrible representative. And so she looked at the law, and the law at the time said that if you were a person who pays your rates or bears a miner's license, you can vote. So through this loophole in the law that assumed that women would never be ratepayers, she wrote herself into history as the very first woman who voted in this country. And I just think, you know, like, it is such an Aussie story of this frustrated woman who runs a pub, who's voting, and looks at the law to try and get rid of a dodgy guy.
That's iconic, honestly. Love that. Fanny Finch, never forget. So you've been running these tours in Canberra, and then it sort of blossomed into something bigger. You actually took a break, you quit your job to go and write a travel guide to women of Australia.
I did. So I was kind of doing the tours as a once a week thing, but I was working full time at first a university and then at a museum. And at the end of 2023, I had a publisher from Hardy Grant Explore reach out, just cold email. And I actually initially thought she was trying to scam me because I just thought no one cold emails you pitching a book. So I didn't respond to her for 3 months. And then I was clearing out my inbox and I actually Googled Hardy Grant Explore, and I was like, oh my God, these people are legit. I wrote back immediately, and then we jumped on a Zoom call like the next day, and she pitched me this idea for a book. She said, we've seen what you've done in Canberra. I don't know how, we're terrible SEO. And she ended up kind of saying, you know, like, we think this would make an amazing national travel guide. And without, you know, thinking through the economics of it, I did not get a big advance or like the reality of what it would mean to write a travel guide. I quit my very well-paid permanent museum job and took off on a, and used my entire advance money, by the way, to buy a 15-year-old Subaru Forester and rooftop tent. And I just started driving around the country. Had no plan. I would not recommend the route that I took. It was chaos. And ended up finding, you know, like hundreds upon hundreds of stories of these incredible women who have shaped history. I had so many amazing conversations. It changed how I viewed Australia. And then I got back and I had to write the book, which was, and they didn't give me an extension. So it was a very intense few months.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Sita Sargent, who is the CEO of She Shapes History. If you can't tell, that is an initiative that is trying to platform women who maybe have been forgotten by history. I'd love to know who the forgotten woman from history you would like to shout out today, someone who doesn't get the credit they deserve. Alison says Judith Wright, known for her poetry, but most people don't know she almost single-handedly stopped oil exploration on the Great Barrier Reef. Janelle says Sister Bullwinkle, an extraordinary nurse in World War II. Another is shouting out Kathleen Butler, who was instrumental in the Sydney Harbour Bridge project. Prime mover and shaker, this person says, diplomatic secretary extraordinaire. Well, Sita, now you've got a new project with the National Library of Australia, mining their archives. Tell me about this project. It sounds even more daunting than you and a 15-year-old Subi driving around Australia.
I'm so excited by this project. So I ended up launching the book at the National Library of Australia last year, and it was just an amazing event. And it kind of sparked this really beautiful relationship with the National Library. And I went back about a month later because I just couldn't stop thinking about them, with a pitch for a kind of quarterly series of talks and attached digital resources, because I'm the world's biggest nerd, that would open up the library to a general audience about all the incredible stories of women who are there. And despite it being the world's most ambitious pitch, they ended up agreeing to it. And over the next 3 years, every 3 months, we are going to be diving into a big like question that will open up the collection. And the first question that we're diving into is one that I asked when I started on my journey, which was, why didn't anyone ever tell me that Australian history was actually pretty interesting? And I've selected three incredible women, one of whom has actually like never engaged with the library before and doesn't think that it's relevant at all to kind of like a young woman of colour in this country, and two of whom are people who have engaged really deeply with the library's collection, but in very different ways.
Who's the person who didn't see the value in being involved?
Her name is Harini, and she's a Tamil Australian woman. So she came here when she was 14 years old, and is someone who's a big Instagram influencer in the South Indian history space, and has a huge platform based in Canberra, and is just someone who like adores history and loves it, and has never felt like the National Library is actually a space that would hold stories that would be relevant to her. And I have had that conversation with quite a few, younger women of colour in particular. So, women like me, you know, as someone whose, mum is from South India. Mm. And I felt that way too, you know, growing up, that this is not, that Australian history doesn't have people that look like me. And I think that the way that we talk about history in this country, even now, is still kind of very, quite literally black and white, and that you end up missing out on all of the nuance and all the incredible multiculturalism that happens in between. And I think that, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately, actually, particularly with the recent anniversary of the first sitting of federal parliament, and how one of the first 10 acts that was passed in parliament was the Immigration Restriction Act, the White Australia Policy, and how that kind of, you know, like set a tone for this country, just not really acknowledging the contributions of people of colour. And I think that the National Library is an incredible space because it holds so much evidence that people of colour have shaped this country. And I'm really excited by this series because it's not only digging out the stories of kind of women in the collection, but also really diverse women who don't usually get spotlighted and platformed. So I'm really excited to kind of dive into that. And to the National Library has been great. They, for every talk, are building out a reading list, so you don't have to go hunting in the collection. They found some great stories, as well as a research guide, so that you can go off and do this research yourself. So it's I'm really proud that we're getting this off the ground. I hope that it works out well. We've committed a lot.
It's such an interesting thing hearing you talk about it, Sita, and so many people are sending me texts with the women that they want to shout out. Dr. Bill Varney says, for a statue in Melbourne, I nominate Dr. Ruth Bishop, who discovered the virus that causes gastroenteritis, rotavirus. This discovery led to a vaccine saving millions of lives. Another health person, Siobhan, says Dr. Heather Mitchell, instrumental in setting up the Victorian Cervical Cancer Registry, bringing rates down to one of the lowest in the world. Another says, John MacArthur's wife, Elizabeth, apparently she did most of the sheep breeding work, but her husband got the credit. And it's making me think about what you said before about the Burley Griffins and this creator, Harini, who's part of your exhibition. Obviously, the people in power have a responsibility to share the spotlight. But I also am struck, Sita, by what you're saying about people maybe leaving themselves out of history because they think they're not going to be honoured, and where the balance is between putting yourself forward, putting your hand up, and the folks in power sharing that mic.
Yeah, 100%. I think that it's something I think about a lot, about who is writing and telling history in this country, and how even now, you know, it's not I'm really hoping with this series that we get more diverse people interested in history and writing that story.
So what's your big takeaway from this project, the women you've encountered in your research?
Oh, so many. But the one that I have been thinking about, I think particularly because it feels like everything is very much getting worse at the moment, is that in Australia, if I've like learnt nothing else from, you know, spending a lot of time thinking and learning about incredible women. And I want to just say I loved that a lot of the women who were being named I recognize. I feel a real sense of relief. is that anyone can shape history in this country. I think that Australia is a small enough country that if you pick an issue and you are really, really relentless about it and you just focus on it, you can make a difference and you can shape history. You might not necessarily be remembered with a statue, but you will be remembered in the legacy that you leave. And I think that Australia is a small enough country as well that like no one's really looking at us. So you can do something really amazing and then it pushes the rest of the world forward. And, you know, like democracy is a great example of that. You know, women getting the right to vote. We really led the way, and it was because Australia was like a low stakes country, so we could experiment. And I think that, you know, if anyone's going to push the world forward, why not it be us?
Absolutely. Well, Sita, all the best with your project. You are shaping history in the work that you're doing. Sita Sargent, CEO of She Shapes History. You can check out their website if you want to keep up with the National Library of Australia series. But do stick around here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, Australia spends billions of dollars on gambling each year, and we are among the biggest losers per capita in the world. Sean McAuliffe has been trying to figure out what's behind our punting obsession, and he is going to join me next. Gambling is Australia's national sport. It sounds like hyperbole. I'm going to throw some stats at you to back it up. One of our most iconic landmarks, the Sydney Opera House, was entirely funded by the sale of 86.7 million lottery tickets. And we're home to a fifth of the poker machines in the world. Only one in three of us are having a regular punt, but we lose billions of dollars each year betting. And the risk of rise of online gambling has changed the game. There are growing concerns that children and young people are at risk of serious harm. So, how can we protect future generations from slipping into the darker side of such a popular Aussie pastime? But with me is Sean McAuliffe, comedian, writer, filmmaker. He's been delving into the roots of Australia's gambling obsession for his new documentary. Sean, welcome to Life Matters.
Tegan, thank you very much. Wow, I've never been called a filmmaker before.
Well, you've made three films and they're airing on the ABC now, so congratulations. It feels like you are very underqualified to make this series, given that you admit, like in the first couple of minutes of the show, that you haven't had a punt since you were in your 20s.
Yeah, but I think that's my superpower. I can go in without any judgment or preconceptions, and to a large extent, I hope I'm the audience, you know, and that's what a host or a presenter maybe should be. Certainly in my position, you kind of take the curtain and you open it up and say, hey, come in here, this might be interesting. Let's learn these things together. So, I mean, the motivator for me was that I have three sons who are in their 20s and probably exactly the demographic that's being pursued and courted, seduced perhaps by some of the gambling companies. And that made me think, oh, well, I haven't got any advice for them because I don't gamble. I genuinely don't understand what it is that prompts people to do it, or if they have difficulty not doing it, why don't they just say, well, it's not working for me, I'll just stop. I mean, that's an attitude I think a lot of people have. It's the same with drinking. You just go, well, I don't get why you continue to do it. But of course, we're all bunches of toggles and switches, and there are lots of reasons why we do these things. And so I went in to talk to both sides of the table, I suppose, the people who make the games and encourage you to play the games and the people who do play the games.
You've talked to a really broad cross-section of the people who play the games, like from young dudes, you know, betting on the footy every weekend, to a 105-year-old woman whose second home is her bingo hall.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, like that's a good example of the dichotomy, I suppose. You've got it's kind of an all-consuming pursuit of watching an NRL match and maybe not even barracking for either side, but just betting on what I didn't know about multis before. So apparently, you can bet on what someone's going to do in 10 seconds, or you know how many tries there'll be, or that sort of thing. You know, so you're not even really worried about the outcome. It's all it's what's happening within the game. And then way over on the other side of the ledger is my 105 year old companion who introduced me to bingo, which seemed like a lovely thing. You know, there's a genuine social utility that comes from that. We have a number of people of a certain age who would otherwise perhaps not have got together, and they're spending like $2 or something like that. And my 105-year-old companion was much better at it than I was. I'm serious. I missed it. I would have done quite well. In fact, I wanted to immerse myself in this world, and I've only ever gambled once, so I did it with everyone I was with, because that's exactly the environment that I was in, and I wanted to participate and see what it was like to win and see what it was like to have the feeling of loss. Unfortunately, I won every time I...
Unfortunately.
I did, yeah. I mean, it wasn't good. The ABC said, well, you're not... This is not a good thing. And I said, well, that's the way it was. I did continually win, which I don't recommend. That is not the message. I don't want that to be the message and the takeaway from this documentary series, that you can always win.
You should have called the series Sean McAuliffe is Not a Loser.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I should have. It should have really been all about me. Exactly. My lucky streak.
So, okay, but you were winning, right? Like, did you get that buzz? Did you sort of understand that attraction for people?
No, I didn't. No, that's the other thing. And I think there might be three groups of people. People who, like me, just it doesn't do anything. Like if I'm sitting on a roller coaster, nothing happens. Like I don't get excited and I don't get worried. You know, maybe I'm not a human being. I don't know. It just didn't tap into anything. And then there are other people who just love that suspense, I suppose, of the tension between betting and getting some result. It's not about where you end up. It's the thrill of the chase. I mean, obviously, when problems arise, there are other things that are causing you to continue to pursue it. I understand that. But there's people who love it, the roller coaster, and there are people who don't like the roller coaster. And there's me who can just take it or leave it and think, well, you don't go anywhere. You don't end up anywhere. Why go on it? And maybe I think that about gambling, because it's particularly these days with the apps and the nothing else is associated with the gambling. It's not like you can go and have a chat with your friends or a drink with your friends or dress up or play another game or, you know, it is reductive and that is all you are doing on your phone. That is entirely the point of the app. And the companies aren't making anything. So when we say, oh, well, Australians lose $32 billion a year, that's accurate. It's not like the companies have made that, because they haven't made anything and sold anything. They have just, put a hose in your pocket and pocket of a certain percentage of our population and siphoned out a considerable sum of money. And there's a lot of damage that results. And we do look at that. We look at the good stuff and the fun stuff as well as the other stuff, because that's how life is. The dark clouds were a bit of a surprise to me. I think I'm a bit of a Pollyanna, but I did wake up a little bit having done this series in a way that I think any other TV project I've ever done has been a distraction from problems. And this one is about, I guess, things that are fast becoming a problem.
Mm. You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor chatting with Sean McAuliffe, who is the host of the new ABC documentary series, Going for Broke. It's about our gambling obsession, trying to look at both sides of gambling, the harm it can do that we hear a lot about, but also the reasons why people get into it and seem to enjoy it. I'd love to know how you think we could reshape our relationship with gambling in Australia. Margaret says, my local RSL runs bingo for kids in the school holidays. Tongue in cheek, start them early. Another, Sean, this is for you. I watched Sean McAuliffe's On the Source program when I was 14 and helped me decide to never touch a drop of alcohol. Hopefully this new show can have a similar impact on my fellow Australians.
Oh, well, that's very gratifying to hear. I mean, that particular documentary series, again, I tried to go in without judgment, and I don't drink, so I didn't have any advice for my then teenage children, about the same age as your listener. Laid out all on the table, and she's worked it out for herself. That's great, because I think if people do stop and think about something they maybe had never considered, they just feel they do it, or they just do it unthinkingly. Then that's the point. That's the tick, I think, at the end of the that makes it all worthwhile. So that's really good. I'm glad I heard that.
Let's talk about some of what you discovered about the sort of psychology of gambling. What is happening in other people's brains, not yours, when they're gambling? What toggles and lights are lighting up, as you said before? Yeah. Talk to me about the gambler's fallacy.
Yes, well, we did spend a bit of time, and it's certainly in this first episode where I went into an RSL again, first time. A lot of first time experiences for me. These documentary series, they do open up the windows to the world during this. So I went into an RSL for the first time. I sat with a lady by the name of Maureen, and she regularly attends this particular poker machine, and she feels that if she feeds it enough, then it will reward her. And I think that's a very common feeling for people gambling generally, is that they feel that something or someone, Lady Luck, Dame Providence, somebody in the universe, some force in the universe will look after them and reward them. Maybe they feel they deserve it. They need a break. They're going to get lucky in a minute. It's almost religious in a way. And it's comforting, I think, for some people to think that I'll be looked after, that the world will look after me, the universe will see to me that I'm okay. And that, that can enable you to pursue your gambling well beyond what reason would suggest to you be reasonable. And other people, like in Maureen's case, she said, look, I've paid all my bills for this week, and I've got $25 or $30 here, and I'll be here for 4 hours. I get to see my friends and have a coffee with them. And then she'll go to the solitary machine. Everybody's at a single machine. So maybe the bingo hall is a bit more social. But anyway, no judgment. And for her, that's worth the $20 or $30. So many people don't have any problem as a result of playing these machines. But for other people, there's just a kind of a hole they fall into, and they're lulled. And it's only afterwards, and we did speak to somebody who did have problems, and she was constantly bargaining with herself, she told me, when time was coming very close to when she should go and pick up her son from school. And for her, that bargaining ended up taking her to a point where there was no time to do it, so therefore she had to ring her mother to go and pick up her son. And felt terrible shame afterwards. So I think the psychology of people who end up having great difficulty with gambling is that it's like any addiction. You are just right in the very center of a particular moment, and it's very hard to see yourself and project yourself into the future, or review the promises you made when you walked into the venue. You are just held in that particular moment, and that's where you want to be. I found that a revelation, and I found that very worrying, particularly when children are being introduced to the idea of gambling and the normalisation of it when they watch a game of sport on television.
A text here from Chris saying, I've just discovered that a 40-year-old person I have known for a long time gambles on their phone for up to 6 hours a day and has now started gambling on their phone while driving. Talk to me, Sean, about what you found about this rise of online gambling, where really, like you said before, all of the social accoutrement of the way we used to gamble is taken away, and all you really have is just the game in your pocket all the time.
Well, you're lucky if it's in your pocket. I think it's often in your hand, that device. And the other thing is, I guess the phone, or rather the gambling companies through the app on your phone, are constantly pinging and tapping you on the shoulder and saying, hey, it's been a week since you've done any gambling. We put $50 in your account. Maybe you'd, we'll have a good time. Have a good time this weekend, because this is happening and that's happening. So if you are, I don't want to make any judgments, but if you are unfortunate enough to be a VIP for some of these gambling companies, we did speak to somebody who'd gone to prison because they had decided to, they had felt they had no option but to embezzle funds from where they were working in order to support their habits. So he went away for 9 months, and he said to me when he came out, and he very generously gave me that moment where he came out of prison. We actually see him come out of prison. I get to speak to him straight away when it's all very fresh. And he said, well, you don't they don't court your business if you're a winner. They only court your business if you're a loser. So usually it's the vulnerable or the already in trouble people that end up being afforded these extra sums of money or special deals or that sort of thing. So that was a revelation for him. He thought he was special because he was a VIP, but really they're just pursuing him. And in fact, if you do win a lot, this happens in casinos as well as online, if you are a winner, then you are asked to leave. You know, in some quarters, the definition of a problem gambler is somebody who wins all the time. That's the definition that's probably sitting on the desk at the gambling companies.
What did the gambling industry have to say in their defence?
We found it very difficult to get people to talk to us from that side of the table. I mean, we spoke to the CEO of Wagering Australia, who is the, I guess, public-facing bit of the industry, and they represent a number of gambling companies. Anyway, it's very nice of him to sit down and talk to me about it. There seemed, even in the gentle conversation we had, and all of the conversations I have are gentle, I'm certainly not cross-examining anybody, but there were inherent contradictions, I think, within what was being put to me, which will, I believe, be apparent from watching it. So it certainly didn't need me to comment on it. We tried to get into the to some of the larger city races, horse races, I think people are worried. I think these companies are worried when we, especially if we're from the ABC, there's an assumption that maybe it's going to be a hatchet job or there's going to be some criticism that we're, you know, they wanted to see the footage, for example, that we were taking. They wanted to see what the editorial was. In other words, if you agree to that, then of course it becomes sort of propaganda because you're trying to make it pleasant enough for them to say, yes, you can put that to air. So we didn't want to make that, sell our soul to the devil in that regard. So we were on the periphery a lot of the time, and the result of that was that instead of going to the big fancy races, we went out to the country races, which they were very happy to have us there, and it seemed fine. Like it seemed that there's no coverage, there's no sort of coverage in terms of you being able to use your phone, so you are stuck with what's in your pocket, and there's about a million other things going on. It seemed quite a nice community driven, maybe it's like it was in the old days, I suppose. And there's like four races, and that's it, and then everyone has a, you know, sausage sandwich and goes home. but as I say, a lot of that, everything other than the gambling has fallen away, and that probably is the worry that we're dealing with at the moment. It's why it's in the news cycle. It's why the federal government have decided to introduce partial bans on advertising during sporting games. And this might be the old lawyer in me, but I don't know whether you can have a partial ban. I think it's either a ban or it's not a ban. I don't know what a partial ban is, other than a diluted, slightly ineffective idea of prohibition. But anyway, there are about 30 of these recommendations in the Murphy Report, which are finally now being embraced, I suppose, the top couple of them, and maybe there's a bright light at the end of the tunnel. If we're going down a tunnel, there seems to be some light in it now that the federal government's doing something about it. But most of the time, it's the state governments that are going to be and territory governments in charge of setting up some guardrails for the gambling industry and its users.
So, Sean, you went into making this series with your sons in mind. Have you come away from it feeling any better equipped to give them advice on gambling?
Yeah, I think so. I think I know, because I'm not a sports guy, I don't tend to watch a lot of I don't watch any sport. I don't watch football matches. So to sit down with a couple of families, you know, I was invited to some barbecue, and we sat down and we were watching an NRL match. I'd never seen an NRL match in my life. And I was struck by just how much advertising and bunting there is for various betting companies. I think Sportsbet might even have a bolster around the try post so that when someone scores a try, then is that what it's called? Scores a try, that you actually got that right in your face, you know, the literally in the case of the player if he bumps into it. But and again, I've got a Pollyanna-ish view of life, I think. I was just surprised by that and thinking, wow. And to even talking to the kids who were there, they were looking forward to when they turned 18, when it's almost a rite of passage they're anticipating, like having their first drink. And it's become that. I think it's become, and maybe should be treated in the same way as alcohol and tobacco were a few years ago with advertising, particularly relating it to sport. It is a health issue. That was one of Peter Murphy's, in the Murphy Report, that was one of the major findings, is that maybe, in fact, definitely it should be treated as a health issue rather than a social issue.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for joining me. All the best with the series, which goes out from 8 p.m. tonight. Sean McAuliffe's Going for Broke premieres on ABC TV at 8. You can also stream the whole series on iView right now. And thank you for your text as well. Mary says, 60 years ago, aged 12, I spent all my school fate money on magic envelopes. Didn't win, lost it all, never gambled again. Another says, the problem is the business model. The greatest losses are in the lowest income postcodes. This exacerbates growing inequality. We'll stick around on ABC Radio National. It's Life Matters. Coming up, what if the key to being a perfect parent was less perfection and more trust in your kids' resilience? But first, the school library is full of hidden treasures, which is where a young Andy Griffiths stumbled across a book that showed him how something totally fantastical could also be totally accessible. It is notoriously hard to hold the attention of teenage boys, but for Andy Griffiths, a book, a novella actually, landed in his hands at the right moment in high school. It set him on the path to become an award-winning author of titles that no child of any age can walk past without at least wanting to take a look inside, like The 78-Story Treehouse and The Day My Bum Went Psycho. He's now serving as the Australian Children's Laureate, but today he's here to tell you about the book that changed his life.
Hi, I'm Andy Griffiths, best-selling children's author and Children's Laureate 2026-27, and the book that changed my life is Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis. When I first came across Metamorphosis, I would have been in Year 10, reading enthusiastically, but needing to find something that really connected my love of Twilight Zone-style comics and fairy tales with the adult world. And Metamorphosis is a dark fairy tale of a man who wakes up in the body of an insect and has to navigate what's happened to him and how he's going to live the rest of, well, get through the rest of the day. I found Metamorphosis in my school library and just came across it at random. Shout out to school librarians who are putting all the weird and wonderful books that I could never have found by myself. But there it was, and the first sentence was, "One morning Gregor Samsa woke up and found himself trapped in the body of a giant insect." What grabbed my attention about this book was the matter-of-fact way it described a outlandishly nightmarish situation. It wasn't saying, "Whoa, he's a giant bug." It was just, he woke up and found he was in the body of an insect, and he thought, "Oh dear, I'll be late for work." And that really unlocked the door between real life and fantasy for me, that you could narrate a fantasy situation as if it's happening to you, a trick that I then used to in all of my subsequent story writing. Metamorphosis is too well written to be able to discern a particular lesson from it. Over the years, it's changed for me. I used to see it as a tragedy, and it is as such, but when you read it and reread it, you discover that this is part of the cycle of life, and that his younger sister, it ends on a positive note, that she's now entering adolescence and is changing herself. So it's a beautiful, dreamlike fable. But as I said, what it taught me was that you can narrate the most fantastic events with a very straight voice, and it seems perfectly reasonable, and you can get people to believe impossible things through fiction. I come back to Metamorphosis every few years and marvel at it all over again. And as I'm talking, I also realise it led me into film with David Lynch's Eraserhead, I think is directly related to the type of fantasy world that we're in. One of the things I like the best about Metamorphosis is its brevity. It's not as long as a novel, it's longer than a short story, so it falls into novella. And in these times where we're time poor and you don't always feel like you want to invest in a really long book, this is the one you can knock over in an afternoon, and then you will be able to say you've read one of the true classics of literature. If Franz Kafka was sitting across the table from me right now, I would simply say thank you. I don't think you had an easy life, but thank you for being so faithful to your inner life that it resonates with a kid from the eastern suburbs of Melbourne 80 years later. I'm Andy Griffiths, and that was the book that changed my life.
Andy Griffiths, award-winning author, Australian Children's Laureate. His book, Metamorphosis, by Franz Kafka. If you want to read, he was really selling it there. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. To be a parent is to feel low-key guilty a lot of the time. The stakes of raising up a good, happy, successful human are so high, and it feels like everyone's got an opinion on the optimal way of doing it. Wanting to do it well is normal, but seeking out advice among your friends or in books or on social media can just feed the feeling of exhaustion and fear that you're not quite doing it right, which might be why the beta parenting trend is striking a chord. It's a response to the intense helicopter parenting of recent years. Less perfection, less micromanaging, more trust in your kids' resilience, embracing imperfection and giving yourself permission to be a human as well as a parent. You're about to hear from a psychologist on this trend soon, but I do want to hear from you. Do you feel pressure to parent in a certain way? How have you decided what standard to hold yourself to as a parent? With me is Christine Bagley-Jones, our resident psychologist. She joins me fortnightly for Head and Heart. Christine, if you were placing yourself on the Greek letter scale, where would you put yourself as a parent?
Well, it's funny because I did ask my kids this morning and they actually brought up, well, there's not just two parenting styles that they're aware of. They talked about soft parenting and the tiger mum. And then it made me realise it's not just a dichotomous situation where it's one or the other. There's lots of different flavours, and I'd like to think of myself as someone that responds to the child's needs. And I think the kids would argue that I have parented differently with each of them depending on their temperaments.
That is interesting. I want to dig into that in a little bit, but first let's talk about beta parenting as a movement. When did it first come across your radar?
I think it's been bubbling up for some time, and of course I've read a little bit about it. I guess they've always existed, you know, hippie parents, you know, parents that are very in the moment, like to take their life slower, so naturally their parenting style will reflect that. But of course, I've seen it ramped up in the last couple of years, which in my mind makes perfect sense.
It seems to me, so if we're defining it as basically a backlash to really intensive helicopter parenting in a very judgment-free space, the idea of beta parenting just sounds like parenting as maybe a generation or two in the past and then further back in history would have called it, because if you have seven children and are running a farm, you don't have a lot of time to be sitting down for 20 minutes with each child each night. Like, is this just sort of going back to what the realities of parenting were for previous generations?
Yes, I think so. I think, look, it's a lot about psychological flavours as well and what we're focusing on in terms of what well-being equals for you know, bringing a child up. And I was like, there's, you know, about five rough key elements a child will benefit from. And in fact, the helicopter and the beta parenting is a blend of those if you could bring them both together. So, yeah, I don't think, I like when you said a judgment-free zone, because most parents are just trying to do their best, and there's often flack if they're doing a particular way and it's not in agreeance with what social media is currently trending on. And I want to move away from all that judgment.
Talk to me about these five categories you were talking about.
I've put myself on the spot now to remember them. Well, from a schema perspective, Jeffrey Young cited, you know, that you need to have a secure attachment. So that would be where you spend that time with the child so that they learn that they're life is safe and that you're there for them. There's also that need for autonomy and that free thought and that ability to make your mistakes and learn things maybe through trial and error. And then there's also the need for spontaneous play during a childhood, that needs to be executed regularly and not to be so busy that you don't have time just to be creative. It's, and then also about being able to express how you feel. And that bit's interesting because I call it the Brussels sprout scenario, where the child can potentially say they don't want to eat their Brussels sprouts and they're upset about it, and the parent takes the time to let them express themselves. They might still have to eat the Brussels sprout though. So it's about expression. And then finally, it's the healthy boundaries and knowing, and that's again, a little bit helicopter, where you make it very clear where, you know, the boundaries are. But also you can have that happening in any kind of parenting style as well. All these five can be infused into any style.
I'm thinking of them as being like dials that you might turn up or down depending on your child. Like what you were saying before, that you say you've parented each child a bit differently. How do you figure out what your kid needs?
Well, it's not easy because they're not going to necessarily tell you. So that's where you sit with them and observe them. You also do a little bit of soul searching because you've been conditioned because of your upbringing. And a lot of people will either mirror their upbringing or rebel and try to do the opposite if they haven't enjoyed it. So being self-aware of how you are showing up and how you want to show up as a mother will be really, really helpful, as well as asking your kid, get feedback. Do you like it when, you know, I let you try to figure that out? Or you tell them it's good to make mistakes. Like you celebrate things not going right for them because it builds resilience, flexibility, problem solving, all those good things.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor with our resident psychologist, Christine Bagley-Jones, for Head and Heart, our fortnightly chat. We're talking about beta parenting, this idea of parenting a bit more hands-off than what you might think of if you've been reading articles about helicopter parenting or intensive parenting, this idea of embracing some imperfection, trusting kids' resilience. I'd love to know how you have decided what the right parenting style was for you and your kids, or how you've seen this play out for your grandkids or your nieces and nephews if you have them. Nell says, the perfect parent leaves something for their child to improve on. Another says, Dobby, i.e. the house elf from Harry Potter, elevated non-matching socks to a fashion statement. But seriously, the message from an early childhood teacher, don't sweat the small stuff. Just get your child to school by 9 a.m, even if they change out of PJs in the car. Christine, can you relate?
Oh, completely. And I celebrate that because it also takes the pressure off the mother, because parents want
or
to
father.
Do the, or father, that's correct. Yeah, parenting. And by being able to say, look, it's okay if your kid comes with their hair not brushed and half their breakfast is still in their hand, because then we get to enjoy the experience of parenting without automatically feeling like we've got to get every little bit correct.
How often are people coming to you, your patients coming to you, discussing this anxiety of being a parent?
A lot, because it's such a big part of one's life once they breed and they've got that huge responsibility of trying to navigate a young person to adulthood. Even if they don't come to therapy for that express dilemma, it'll come up at some point, because usually we're time poor. Usually we are co-parenting with someone else and there can be conflict around styles, and that's a common theme. If you've got someone that's more anxious in their parenting style, more inclined for that helicopter approach, and then their other parent is the opposite, it can be very anxiety producing.
That feels like a conversation you really need to be having with your co-parent, and not just with a third party or trying to work out just by yourself with your kid.
That's right. And in fact, if in an ideal world, you'd want to have these conversations before having the children as well. Like, how do you see yourself as a parent? How micro are you going to go? What's your appetite for letting them fail or have disappointment? Because often this helicopter approach, it's born out of empathy. You just don't want your kid to suffer, not realizing that suffering is inevitable in life, and learning early on that they can survive it and keep moving is such a valuable lesson. So in terms of co-parenting, being on the same page is probably even more important than the style that you elect.
What are some tips for parents who are listening to this, who would love to step back a little bit, maybe cut themselves a bit more slack, but they feel a bit guilty about that?
Mm. And of course, guilt seems to go hand in hand with parenting. The first thing I'd say is you matter also. And I know for a fact that kids love it if their parents are thriving and if they're being good role models in themselves. And that has to include self-care. So if you're always navigating their life and making sure their timetable's on track and they're kicking all their goals and they're feeling fine, where's the time in the day just to nurture yourself, your relationships, your self-care, your hobbies, your interests? When you're thriving, the knock-on effect is they will often as well, because you'll have more bandwidth to be patient. And you're also showing them the importance of that balance.
Well, Christine, thank you so much, as always, for sharing your wisdom with us. Go without guilt today, I suppose, is the message.
Absolutely.
Christine Begley-Jones, our resident psychologist. She joins me fortnightly for Head and Heart. Thank you for your texts too. Kate says, never miss a chance to kiss your kid, even after a fight, or if they annoy you or you them, putting a kid in a car seat, saying goodnight, good morning if you can. Develop a kind and chill fallback position. You are their support crew. It requires self-discipline and self-sacrifice, but that's what adulting and parenting requires. Kate, your text has made me think of the time that my little girl was sitting in the trolley and she was being annoying and I got cranky at her, and then I felt bad and I leant down to give her a kiss right as she snapped her head back and smacked me in the lip and gave me a fat lip at the grocery checkout. Parenting's fun. You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. And thank you for the texts you sent me, shouting out the women who you think are under-remembered in history. One says Georgina Molloy, an early Australian botanist in the south of WA, who sketched native plants and collected seeds, developed relationships with Aboriginal people. Her work was published under a man's name. Another says, I shout out my mother, who found myself with my father returned from World War II with undiagnosed PTSD, depression, and poor health, supported him through several severe hospitalizations and unemployment phases, and raised three children, fed us with her vegetable garden and chooks. She worked like a Trojan her whole life to keep the family in a reasonable lifestyle. How many other women were like this? Another says, thank you so much for this interview. I started following She Shapes History on Instagram back in 2022. Out here in the sticks, it's great to have young historians bring these stories to life. My pick is Sillett McKenzie, an Australian engineer and pioneer in radio technology in the 1920s. She designed the Wrens in code breaking, which sounds like I need to do some Googling for a bit more on Sillett. Well, that is just about it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. I will be back with you again tomorrow. We're going to talk about the friendship wealth gap, when someone that you've grown up with and you've known for your whole life, when your paths diverge financially, and the strain that can put on your relationship, how to navigate that tomorrow on Life Matters. Plus, volunteering. I want to hear about the special volunteering individual who underpins your community. And yes, your car is probably spying on you. Is there anything you can do about it? You'll find out tomorrow on Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you then.
You You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.